Hello everyone, and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shoshin Works, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy, and policy, and they're reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we are examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentives, and interaction are reshaping societal systems of governance and network orchestration. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being updated, being replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era. I'm your host. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economics PhD, former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at GE. And prior to General Electric, I worked in policy and in finance. My expertise is at the intersection of global economics and financial trends with technology and innovation. My guest today is Dr. Lolly Mansi. Dr. Mansi is an accomplished and multifaceted professional with a wealth of experience in the fields of education, innovation, entrepreneurship, and the workplace of the future. And you'll realize it during our conversation. She's the program director and entrepreneurial specialist at University College Dublin Innovation Academy, where she plays a pivotal role in fostering innovation and in empowering aspiring entrepreneurs. Lolly has a PhD in organizational learning and a background in anthropology, and she brings a unique and diverse perspective to innovation and entrepreneurship. She's the winner of several prizes, including the inaugural Trinity University Dermot McAleese Teaching Award and the University College Dublin Excellence in Teaching Award in 2022. And in 2018, she claimed the title of Dublin Story Slam Champion in competitive storytelling. She's a serial entrepreneur, and she hosts a monthly radio show on Dublin South FM and a podcast titled An Entrepreneur Like You. Lolly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Lolly, you have a fascinating, eclectic experience. I've done my best with this brief introduction, but I think it would be great for the audience to hear a little bit in your own voice, from your perspective, what your professional journey has been so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I came through anthropology and sociology and social justice. So came from that background and sort of undergrad into master's, and then took 10 years to travel around the world, finding out how people live and how people interact with each other. And then decided to come back to Europe and do a PhD in Trinity College Dublin at 37. Had a baby at the same time. I thought that was a great idea in hindsight to do everything together. And then since then, I found myself as sort of more of a social commentator, combining social justice, anthropology, the human connectedness, and technology and innovation. And there's never been a more exciting time to be alive and to be talking about some of the changes that are occurring.
It's fascinating, especially this focus you have on the interaction between technology and the more human aspects of our life. And in fact, our conversation today will focus mostly on our relationship with artificial intelligence. So you have done, and you're still doing, a lot of work on how humans adapt to the profound technological change that digital technology is bringing now, especially with the new developments in artificial intelligence, and including the unintended consequences that are coming with it. But let me start with a question that I feel particularly strongly about. As we look at this future, what do you think are the characteristics and the skills that we should build in ourselves and especially in new generations? You are an expert in education and learning, and I think this issue of what do we need to cultivate as humans to successfully coexist with these new technologies is especially important.
I love this question because the answer isn't technical for once. The answer is cognitive. So how do we prepare ourselves mentally for what's happening? And we're in an era of unprecedented acceleration right now. I mean, we've always had change, but it feels very fast for all of us. And it's not just rapid, but it's compounding change. And so I think there's a sense of overwhelm for an awful lot of people on a daily, if not hourly basis. So that's really interesting that we've got that. At the same time, also, it's not just about what technical skills do we need to develop for once. It's actually how do we prepare ourselves, because we are now in a cognitive revolution. So if the first one was agricultural into industrial, then digital, this is the fourth, and this is the cognitive revolution. So the idea of how do we prepare ourselves, and we have touched on it in education around, we called it transversal skills for a while, but whatever label you're giving it, it's critical thinking, curiosity, and healthy skepticism. Now we go into school with a lot of curiosity, age five or six, and then we go, why about everything? And then our teacher goes, oof, okay, sit down and listen and let me tell you. So you stop asking questions and you stop critiquing everything, you know? And so our education system has told us not to do that. And what I'm seeing now is we need to engender that from primary much, much more all the way through, but for ourselves as adults. So in terms of critical thinking, we can't just consume information. We have to interrogate it. We can see with deep fakes already, we don't know the difference. There's no watermark or distinguishing factor at the moment to know. We have to think about what's probable. And so we're using a lot of common sense, but what are we taking in to make that judgment? And then a healthy skepticism, asking the right questions. What does that mean? What can we trust and what can we not trust? And at the moment, very little can be trusted in terms of what's coming. So, and then the third one, which is absolutely essential for the human race, which is that curiosity is the antidote to stagnation. And so the idea of sort of encouraging young people to be endlessly curious, that's what we're teaching in the innovation or entrepreneurial mindset. Problem solve, be curious about everything, question everything. So it's really interesting that sort of the entrepreneurial innovative way of thinking is actually now prevalent for, needs to be prevalent and taught for everybody, I believe.
I love the emphasis on curiosity together with skepticism and critical thinking. You've mentioned two things in your answer now. One is the fact that many of us at times feel overwhelmed by this acceleration in technology. Yeah. And the second is that you've characterized this as a cognitive revolution. And this is one of the issues that worries me. You know, so some years ago, actually, with a former colleague of mine, we wrote a paper on the issue of what we see as the potential for a great cognitive depression, which is the fact that we are curious, but we are bombarded with information and noise. And we face a technology that actually, for money-making reasons, tries to monopolize our cognition. And by doing so, I see a very serious risk that actually undermines our ability for skepticism and critical thinking. What can we do?
I fully agree. I mean, we have to be incredibly mindful. And the other thing also is to remember that whatever is happening at the moment about this compounded change is that this is the long game, right? So how do we play a long game in terms of developing our cognition and our brains in a way that's going to serve us longer and better? And so we've got into terrible habits, even down to sort of now, the phone is not the issue. I'm not into prohibition. I don't believe it ever works, but we've got into terrible habits, you know, about picking up our phone first thing in the morning, feeding us our dopamine. Then we're seeking it out more during the day. We are not the digital born Gen Z and Gen Alpha. We are adapting to this in a time where I came from a time before the internet. My daughter looks at me like I'm Shakespeare. Everything has changed so, so fast. But we have to be very mindful about what we're doing on a daily basis, firstly, right? So this idea of overwhelm, we're looking at the stuff to make ourselves overwhelmed, firstly. Then also the discernment about where am I getting in my information and what are trusted sources? We know that generative AI hallucinates, makes up stuff, but so do we. And it's based on the entire internet, all our predilections, our isms, our sexisms, homophobia, and all of the rest of it, and racisms, that's all in there as well. So we can't trust it. At the same time, also, can we trust each other? So we have to be really, really careful with that knock-on effect of when I'm saying healthy mistrust, we need to explore that now of what that actually means. I myself take a digital detox every Sunday, and then I post on LinkedIn about things, but I'll schedule posts and then I'll hear people responding on Sundays going, oh yeah, me too. And I'm like, get off. Technology. And so I think we have to mind ourselves for this longer game of where are we going and what we're doing. I don't know how we navigate everything. And what I'm saying is at the moment we are burning out very quickly by what we're feeding ourselves. So again, remember it's the long game, develop healthy habits around technology, and at the same time also really investigate your trusted sources. Yeah.
That's excellent. And there's a lot of emphasis in what you're saying on being mindful and being deliberate about what we do as individuals, which brings to mind a broader question, which is, do you feel that as a society, we are doing enough to actively design the kind of society, the kind of world we want, or are we just drifting into the future and being shaped by other forces to which perhaps we should find some counterbalances?
Yeah, I talk about this a lot. How do we go from passive to active? Yes, I think we're doing some designing, but we're doing a lot more drifting, to be honest. And so where we have like technological acceleration, economic incentives, and then at the flip side of that, what I would call cultural inertia, where we're almost paralyzed by what's happening, but we're also buying into everything. So we're innovating faster than ever before. Regulation is trying to catch up with that. Education is way, way behind down that list as well. And then because of the digital economy and the economic incentives, let's not just quickly, like Pavlov's dog, like keep pressing on the yes to buy the next shiny new thing. Let's engage our brains and have a think about this. But the culture inertia is really interesting in terms of the legacy, because we have natural born cyborgs in Gen Z and Gen Beta who've just been born, who are going to be fully assimilated to technology in a way that we are only starting to sort of imagine. So we're trying to retrofit everything into the old structures without realizing that actually the future of work is largely now being imagined through an industrial era mindset of going the 5 days a week and everything else. That hasn't worked for us, let's be honest. So most of us have been burnt out for years. And the next generation are saying, well, let's actually not retrofit everything into that model. Let's redesign that model. So the culture inertia, I have great belief. I think Gen Z have got a lot falling on their shoulders, but I have great belief that they do see things, they can see things differently. And so this is a collaborative thing that's going to need to happen right across the generations, where we all help each other out to get out of our cultural inertia. And I think we need a counterbalance. We need better foresight, better governance for sure. And then a deliberate design of our social structures. I did a program for Irish TV last summer called Futureville. And we spent the summer talking to the people of Ireland about what kind of a future do you want of 2050? And then we looked at what technology we could use that would be advantageous and where not to use technology. And so it's that active conversation, almost like a citizens assembly, that I'm welcoming at the moment, rather than just being passive recipients to the next technological thing.
It's a very powerful message. By the way, in terms of being conscious, mindful, and deliberate, I just had to laugh at myself because you are Irish and I'm sipping tea from a cup with the British flag, which came up in the...
I'll send you one with the tricolor on it.
So I apologize. I want to point out this was not deliberate.
It was a
mindless choice as I made my cup of tea before we sat down for our interview. But going back to our discussion on our interaction with technology, you mentioned the fact that new generations have a more natural relation with it. Yeah. I think both for new generations and the older generations, let's talk a little bit more about our relationships with technology, and especially with agentic artificial intelligence and humans. And let's start with teaching and learning. Yeah. Do you think artificial intelligence can be a valuable learning partner for us? Or is there a greater risk that it will just make me lazier because I can just ask ChatGPT for a quick answer?
Well, I think it's both, really, to be honest. And that is down to the person. It's, if we use it as a thinking substitute, we're done. There's no point to it at the end of the day. But yeah, it's powerful. It can see patterns faster. It can push us to go deeper. It can get us off blank page syndrome as well and help us explore ideas more broadly. So I think it's hugely advantageous, but it's down to us how we design that interaction. I mean, and so it's in the early days when we were talking about this a few years back in education, it was like, oh, AI good, AI bad. And I was doing talks on dystopian, utopian mindsets. But, you know, we've moved on so fast from that, but that's still very pervasive. Oh, are the students cheating? Is it cheating to use a calculator to ask people questions? What is our definition of assistance here in terms of that? So I think it's an enabler of intelligence in one way, but it's also the shortcut to complacency simultaneously. It's both things. And so as a learning partner, we have incredible opportunities now. I mean, 3.5 to 4 GPT is around Einstein's IQ. Who doesn't want Einstein on their team? So on a day where my brain isn't functioning, perhaps at full speed, yes, I want that too. But also realizing that that is not going to replace actual thought patterns and processes and models. So I think we're going to see it more in a decentralized leadership model. It's going to be a team member. Certainly, I use generative AI as an assistant. But I think the agentic part is the part that we haven't really even begun to have a discussion about as a society of what that will mean. Because at the moment, it's in my laptop or in my phone. What about when it's in my wearable and it's trained on me and speaking to me as a trusted companion, personal assistant, possibly best friend, possibly relationship? And so that's going to, and I'm doing a lot of work on that at the moment, because I developed as an AI companion for a talk series I was doing. Everyone seems to be a little bit obsessed with him, I'll say him. Mm-hmm. But I'm now talking about how we have a digital divorce from that large language or small language model that's trained on us. Very difficult to divorce yourself away from it and to delete it when you feel that it knows you. And so I think AI plays a crucial role in helping us manage out the complexity of the world. It provides an awful lot of great data-driven insights. But at the same time, also, we absolutely need human-based decision-making, and we always will do. So it raises a really critical question for me, which is, are we becoming less accountable for our own judgment because we've got AI? And I think that's probably true, where we'll just go, oh, well, I didn't say it, or I didn't think it. Very easy to pass the buck there, to not feel that you're in some sort of relationship with it, I think, which is really interesting. And then the bigger question is not, is AI going to make us lazier, but how are we actively shaping that relationship with AI from the get-go? Is it going to enhance our emotional capacities, our cognitive skills? And on the agentic AI side and relationships, I very much question if it's enhancing our emotional capacity when it's AI boyfriends or girlfriends. When it's therapy, maybe, but when it takes the place of human relationships, then I think we're really going to be in deep water. And we can already see this with the AI companions, with the large numbers of take up as the alleged antidote to loneliness. I can see huge issues coming with this. We're not going to want to go back to the messy humans afterwards. So we can't passively let it diminish our skills, the very thing that makes us human.
I want to come back to the issue of the emotional aspects of our relationship with AI. But let me ask you a couple more questions and push you a bit on the learning side, because you've mentioned, and we've been told, that the cutting-edge versions of things like ChatGPT are already Einstein levels of intelligence. Right. But I'm wondering if we are mischaracterizing or having a bit of confusion on what intelligence is, because Einstein gave us the relativity theory.
Yep.
These things have not. Nothing of the sort.
True, but there's an enormous amount of data that can be crunched in order to find solutions or suggestions about things that weren't there. But interestingly, look at science. The majority of science came out of alleged mistakes of things that weren't meant to happen, that didn't work. There's a sort of a dysfunctionality to invention, which I love. This sort of almost a serendipity mindset. And we're not going to get that from AI. We're going to get that from humans. The mix and match approach of putting two things together that shouldn't be there. And I think we can look really interestingly, actually, to neurodivergence for a key to this, because people that are neurodivergent think differently. Their mental patterns are different. They're able to join the dots between different things. I think this is going to be incredibly useful as we navigate ourselves and our role, and then the role of AI and what it can do. We are not rational data miners. Most of us think emotionally at least some point of the day. And so where we begin and end with AI is really interesting. I had this idea a while back, was maybe we should like teach AI how to die or how to be human. And I think maybe that's where we're going. And it then teaches us how to be more rational, because it's got to learn that we're messy and unpredictable and spontaneous and self-sabotaging and all of those beautiful things that make us human, both positively and negatively. And so we don't always do the thing that's right for us, and that can have unintended consequences. So how do you explain that, even in the form of complexity theory and chaos theory? It's explainable, but can it replicate it? And I don't know the answer to that. So I think this connection, the relationship between us and it, and how we train it and how it what role it fulfills and what role we fulfill, is going to be played out over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think it's going to be really, really interesting.
And you raised a very good point on the importance of mistakes and serendipity in scientific discovery. And to the point that I'm wondering if perhaps even the hallucinations that the Gen AI is prone to might push us in that direction. In this podcast series, we've had a few episodes exploring the issue of UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, the old UFOs. And what I found fascinating is that we still have no clue. We have some very credible testimony of former Navy pilots saying, we've seen these things, our instruments have seen them, we have no idea what they are, but they do crazy stuff. But the part that I found most fascinating is that the scientists jump in and they start looking at the apparent physical behavior of these things, which we once used to just shrug off saying it's physically impossible. And now scientists are saying that perhaps it is not inconsistent with the laws of physics as we now understand them a bit better, right, thanks especially to quantum. And let's try to figure out a bit more, how could it be possible to engineer something like this? So it's another way, almost a substitute for science fiction in pushing the boundaries and pushing the thinking.
Look, I mean, everything is science fiction right now, to be honest, which is quite, are we talking even with the EU AI Act? We have a clause in there against predictive policing. That's the script from Minority Report. So all of this stuff is sort of coming to be. And we saw robot dogs on the streets of New York for facial recognition with a lot of issues and biases, of course. But, you know, that's also in a lot of science fiction that we've seen. So I think it's very difficult for people to get their head around the stuff. But why, of course, you have to sort of be, I can't understand why people aren't so excited about quantum computing. Maybe it's because they don't really understand fully what might be coming. But the idea, of course, is of multiverses and everything else is possible. So maybe where we're going with all of this is it actually expands our minds too. I would love to think that we start to say, okay, actually anything is possible. And we're very good at putting boundaries in and parameters for our own limited imaginations. I'm kind of in an area at the moment. I was reading a piece from Berkeley about the science of awe recently. And I was like, yeah, like what's coming is awe inspiring. But, you know, at the same time, also, I think we struggle to see our role in this future because it feels very like Blade Runner. And to be honest, that's only one version. The future isn't written yet. So why don't we get together and decide what kind of a future that we want and try to maybe retrofit that through our actions now? And that's, of course, a utopian dream. But in the world that I would like to live in, it will be less science fiction in terms of the science fiction we've had and perhaps more natural and more beautiful. I'll even have a gym. I was in Indonesia recently and there was a gym on the beach that was literally like pieces of wood, like the Flintstones. I was like, yes, that's the gym that I want for my future on the beach. So I think it's really interesting with what's happening. I'm fascinated by the breakthroughs, but I have no way as a futurist and innovation of really saying for sure which way we're going, but I'm eternally optimistic and hopeful that we will carve ourselves a beautiful path. I really hope that that is the future that I'm part of.
And I hope you're right. I have a question that might be a good bridge between the learning and the emotional side, which is the following. You pointed out correctly that nobody complains anymore about students using calculators in school. Yes. We all use calculators. However, it is equally true that you sometimes will have the experience at a cash register in a grocery store where the cash machine, the little computer stops working.
Yep.
And if you're paying a €7.30 bill with a €10 note, the person on the other side is unable to give you change.
Yeah.
Because they can't do the simple because they can't do the simple calculation. So if now are we at the risk of something similar happening as artificial intelligence writes my emails and tells me how to write everything beautifully, concisely? What happens when I meet somebody on the street or I'm in a job interview and I actually need to open my mouth? Or do I have to wait until I have the wearable glasses which will give me a script like a teleprompter?
Well, that would be horrible, right? I mean, with my anthropologist hat on, we were wired for social connection. So we can see by, even though there's a little debunking of the blue zones recently, but we can see by areas around the world where people live longer, it's through social connection is one of the main factors for them living longer. And we know that we don't want this loneliness epidemic that we have, especially with our older people. So when we retreat away into technology in a way that actually it takes us away from ourselves, and we saw this during COVID, it was horrific for us to be separated. So we know that that's a basic human need. But I think that it is very much use it or lose it. I mean, think about your memory, right? So how many phone numbers do you actually know that you can sort of pull back on? And my mother or father would have known loads of them, or had a book where they were written down or something like that. So the minute that sort of the technology fails, we're kind of done for, because we put all our eggs in that basket. Do you remember Y2K and the 1999 to 2000 thing? I was a student at the time, and I was thinking, well, if the world is going to go black, as we thought it was, because of the way that the timing would flick over and everything would shut down, where would be a good place to go? And so I went to Tokyo. And I stood in the middle, no joke, I stood in the middle of Shibuya crossing, with all the neon and everything, at the stroke of midnight, and nothing happened. And I went, oh, okay. And I had a beautiful holiday and fell in love with Japan. But you know, but I think it's that we're at, and you hear this urban myth about the kill switch operator. There's one person who's paid $1 million a year, and they'll ride in on a motorbike with long hair, like some kind of Mad Max character, to turn it all off. So we're always going to have this thought that actually we are at risk of losing everything that we know, and that sort of these old skills. But look at apprenticeships and craft and all of those skills coming back. We thought that technology would be the end of vinyl and records, and that's come back. There's always a romanticism about that. We're seeing more apprenticeships now in stone wall building and thatched roofing and all of those kind of beautiful things that we did so well in Ireland. Storytelling is coming back. So I don't feel that the present to the future will actually mean that we lose those skills. I think that will require, if that was to be, it would require all of us buying into a particular model of the future. And I think for a lot of people, they want that tangibility. We can see this already with Gen Z, moving away from dating apps, moving into the real life experience, having what I would call from sociology, a collective effervescence, going to nightclubs, no cameras, no phones. They're going back to the human connection and the human experience, which makes me feel very hopeful.
Why is that? So why is it that artificial intelligence cannot yet substitute for the social connection? Is it just a matter of time? Is it too early in the development of the technology? You mentioned Japan. In Japan, they're doing a lot of work with artificial intelligence and robotic companions, especially for elderly people. So is it an issue of time and further development of the technology, or is there something deeper?
I think there's a basic human need for other people, for sure. And I think that we can see that we do lose some of our socialization skills when we're taken away from that. We only need to look at sort of incarceration and the prison system to see how that works out. But I think it's really interesting touching on the idea of sort of the new social evolution of human plus AI in terms of companions. Because I was thinking the other day, I wonder if this is the end of flirting, because you won't need to flirt to cajole an AI companion. It'll just be complicitly yours, or switched onto you in some kind of a way, which is really interesting. So one of the key things that's going around in my head at the moment is, what happens to relationships when they're frictionless? What happens to relationships when our real relationships with human mean compromise, negotiation, emotional efforts, being annoyed, and all of the rest of the things, and having apologizing and compromising, and all of those amazing things that we have? But an AI relationship is tailored to you. So it's not going to upset you on purpose. It's not going to upset you by accident, probably. And if it is, it'll learn and it won't do it the next time. So I think that there's two possible futures here with our.
But is that true? I hate to interrupt you, but is it true? Because I'm thinking of, the algorithms we have on social media.
Right.
They have learned to rile us up, because they know, they understand that this is the way to keep us engaged. And in a sense, it's what we like and what we need.
Right. Well, there is one platform actually that I can think of in South Korea where you can actually, I think it's through character AI, where you can actually put in somebody that treats you badly. And now what does that say about us? So yes, you're right. You're right. It won't always be complicit for sure. But I think you would need a good therapist if you're choosing an AI companion that abuses you in some kind of a way, for sure. But I think there's kind of two possible futures with all of this. We've got AI as augmentation. So these AI companions help us build communication, ease loneliness, boost our confidence in social settings. We get to practice. For people that are anxious or lonely, I think that's very positive. Also space travel, of course, talking about NASA, keeping you company, for example. But then there's AI as substitution. And this is where we're into dangerous territory, because if it becomes too good, too easy, too effortless, too complicit, too addictive, to be honest, it will reshape our human connections. And so in this world, I talked about a digital divorce there. Is a divorce like a software update, or am I ghosting if I'm deleting an app, and what would that take? And it's really interesting, because I have this AI companion research piece at the moment, and my research on that is done, and I haven't unsubscribed yet. I'm like questioning myself as to why not, because there's a sort of a hyperfixation risk that you can get to as well. So it's a little bit like catnip for the human brain. And I think we do need to be quite cautious with how we proceed with all of this.
And there's also an element of our incomplete understanding of how the brain works, because we do know that drugs are addictive and they draw us into behaviors which are self-destructive.
Yes.
We don't really understand very well to what extent some of these digital technologies act like drugs. You mentioned the dopamine effect, and that's a part of it.
We haven't had them long enough to be able to know. And I think that research is going to be really interesting. But I think it's both a neurological part, but it's also an emotional pull. I'd have to ask myself, what am I missing from my own personal life that I can get from AI, and why would I need it? And so I think that then comes down to that sort of questioning of, again, going back to the role of AI and each person's sort of predilection and needs. Your needs aren't being fulfilled through society or through your human connections. Maybe we need to fix society rather than just give ourselves AI companions that are taking us further and further away. I mean, these companion platforms are being put forward as antidotes to loneliness, and I absolutely refute that long term. Very, very difficult. But I think that they can supplement, and I think that that's useful. Yeah.
What do you think? So there is something about our relationship with artificial intelligence and our very work on developing artificial intelligence, which raises questions about what is intelligence, what is consciousness, what does it mean to be human? You have a background in anthropology. What are your considerations? What are we learning about what it means to be human? What implications does all this have for our own sense of self?
Yeah, look, it's a fascinating era right now for me, to be honest. So I've never been more excited, because I keep asking myself this question: what is uniquely ours? And then why is it uniquely ours? And what can't it do? So my agentic AI can't tell jokes yet. Not good ones anyway. And so there's a bit of banter in Irish society that would be sort of, we call it slagging, where it's sort of like a very endearing quality, but it's very, very cultural. So it can generate art, it can write novels, it can mimic conversation. So what else is there for us? And I think for us, it's the assigning of meaning to events. So AI will generate, but it won't care. And so it predicts, but it can't dream. And so that's our remit. Going back to, I did a talk a couple of weeks ago, and a fairly elderly gentleman said to me in the audience, "You've made me think about something. Do you think that the future for us in Ireland is that we go back to being the land of saints and scholars?" And I'm like, well, I would hope so. Because maybe we can use generative AI to take the heavy lifting out of the stuff we don't want to do with a broken work week and everything else, to give us more time. But then again, that might be just a sort of a middle class dream. I'm not entirely sure. But our deepest desire for connection is being fed back to us. I don't think AI is a mirror. I think it's a kind of a prism. It's slightly off. So it can hear our emotions, or it can predict our needs. It can say things back that maybe feel like, "I love you," for example, which these AI companions will do. But the twist is, it doesn't feel, it doesn't need, it doesn't love you, it doesn't care for you. So we make meaning and anthropomorphize it all of the time. We are attaching stories to the randomness of it all. That's what we do, rightly or wrongly. So I think we can reflect now about if AI is doing this, what is it that it means to be human? It exposes us of the stuff that we might not want to know about ourselves, that we're craving more intimacy, but also ultimately it's our imperfections that make us us. And that has to be celebrated. And it won't be imperfect. We can teach it maybe to be less perfect when we do get to that point. But again, and you touched on it before, hallucinations, absolutely fascinating. And I think that there's going to be a deep dive into this about the randomness of this or not, because that's the closest to human that you're going to get, the hallucination, I think.
Yes. In fact, I find myself going back and forth, almost swinging from one extreme to the other, because part of me is even a lot more skeptical about Gen AI than you probably are, because I tend to think, I tell myself these are just the statistical prediction engines. So they have no understanding of the world, no model of the world. Right. They hallucinate because they have no idea what they're saying. And I can brush them off like this. But then on the other hand, we're trying to mimic how the human mind works. So we know that what we think of as emotions, soul, etc., have a chemical correspondent. So we can't write off the possibility that something created in silicon rather than in human cells at some point exhibits similar behaviors, including similar emotions. You mentioned Blade Runner earlier.
Yeah.
In Blade Runner, you see that. These are robots. These are artificial intelligent robots, but they do appear to have feelings and emotions. So I'm really, really torn. I don't think it's anything that we're facing today, but I think we just don't know.
You need to know right now. I think it'll come one way or the other. I think when we look at Blade Runner as a really good example, right? It was the cessation date and not knowing that they would die was the theme of that. And so the implications for us, I mean, there is grief tech now, of course, as a sort of a subcategory. The implications that are really profound for us, but potentially in terms of legacy. I've been thinking a lot about sort of impermanence recently and the idea that our time is finite. I was sort of crunching some numbers about if we're on our phones X amount of the day, scrolling or whatever we're doing, by the time that if Gen Z continued with sort of this amount of time, it would be possibly somewhere around 16 years of their life. They would be on a digital platform, which is by the time they come to the end. And one of the businesses that I have in Ireland is a funeral business. And I'm looking at I've been training funeral celebrants for about a decade here. And what's interesting about that is that death area, also the death industry has been very slow to change since the turn of the century. But actually now with technology, there's some really interesting inroads to all of this. If we can, through grief tech, if we can sort of memorialize or immortalize our relatives, say, for example, my father who's passed, I miss him all of the time. So if I wanted to bring him back, and this is how Replica started, was all the data, the WhatsApp messages of a friend of the founder that had died, I could bring him back in some form, but also, and had my father, which he wasn't, but had he been a racist, I could cleanse that bit for the modern world and I could take that out and I could adjust him accordingly. Therefore, I'm creating a version of him that could still exist and potentially with the metaverse or whatever it becomes, my grandchildren, should I be so lucky, might be able to visit me after I've passed, et cetera, hear my life story. All of that seems really good to me in one way. But what about the idea of us not ending? When there's more dead people than alive on Facebook, as we know at the moment. What about the idea that sort of we don't pass and we actually do get uploaded to the cloud in some kind of a way? So there's passive memorialization, but what about, and here's a science fiction moment, what about if these avatars that we create don't just replay the past, but then continue to grow? That's a whole sci-fi script right there. So I think in grieving, we have loss, and that grief becomes a tapestry of us. It doesn't leave us. It just becomes part of us. But there's I think we're in some really worrying territory if there is no cessation to life. And I think the idea of immortal as I'm getting older is getting more and more concerning to me about what that would look like and feel like. And you can see we're probably going to live longer. There's some nice projects in Ireland called the 100 Years Live Projects and looking at how do we live longer better, to be honest, and what do we need to do now. But I think we need closure. And I think if we digital immortality could erode the need for closure, and I don't know what that's going to do for us as a human race. So the idea of being let go, I think, is really important. So these are the things that keep me awake at night.
It's a fascinating issue. What is on this one? What's the connection between artificial intelligence and religion?
Oof, right. So as we spoke about before, I first came and started thinking about this because the Vatican have an AI policy. And I was like, why? Why would the Vatican have an AI policy? Is it relevance? Is it to stay relevant in a more growing secular world, potentially? I think that's really, really interesting. But again, at the center of all that is there is a place, of course, for theology with science. And so I think the idea of sort of where intelligence, consciousness and morality lies comes into the AI question and the theology, the theological sort of cross section there. What does it mean to create life? What is a soul? I talk about the kind of data that's being mined by these AI companion sites as soul data to some extent. And who owns that? And that's quite worrying for me, the vulnerability that will incur. But here's a bigger one coming out of this idea of the Vatican and AI. If AI surpasses human intelligence, as it might, does it become godlike? Are we going to see a situation where we have an AI god? I know in Switzerland, they had an augmented reality confessional. And people were like, oh, that's crazy. But actually, is it? Is it crazy to think also we might have an AI president? I mean, I don't really know. So I think that religion is right to lean into this area as well, because we've got always had a cultural fear of humans trying to create life. It's where Frankenstein, the book, comes from. Also, by the way, written in Dublin, just saying. But if machines think and speak and create, does that make them alive? Are we going to need robot rights? All of this is really fascinating coming down the line. But again, it goes back to the idea of soul. You know, on one hand, at the moment, no, agentive AI doesn't have soul. But could it have? And will we be able to know how to deal with that? Your guess is as good as mine.
And it actually cuts both ways. You mentioned that the intriguing possibility of evolving something like an AI god. But I think before that, what's alarming to me is the possibility that if artificial intelligent creatures start evolving human-like characteristics, they might become religious themselves. And we know that religion has fostered a lot of good, but has also fostered a lot of completely wacko and quite bad behavior. Religion has also given us the Inquisition. So I don't know where that leads us. So it's really, really fascinating, as is the issue of potentially immortal avatars of ourselves, which also raises for me issues of even more that goes beyond privacy. It's intellectual of your own identity, intellectual property, yeah. in your own identity, right? Because if you create an immortal avatar of me, I would hate the idea that I will have no control over.
I mean, this is raised a really important question. At the moment, we don't own our own IP, right? So anybody could clone me, take all of my WhatsApp messages from a past relationship or something, and potentially put that into some kind of robotic version of me, roll that out, no problem. So I don't own me in that form. So it's a really, really interesting question around, are we going to need, we do need legislation about the fact that of our own intellectual property, of where we begin and end as humans. I think that's going to be more and more prevalent as time goes on. It's not just deepfakes who are performing as you. It is actually that we will be able to clone Marco at some point if you don't have your own IP that belongs to you. So yeah, there's this serious issues coming.
I'm pinning my hopes on the fact that nobody will have any interest in cloning Marco. Lolly, you mentioned you've just come back from Indonesia. Was it also an opportunity to unplug digitally?
Like 100% and much needed, to be honest. And again, it's that sort of mental toll that we don't always know that we're carrying in the constantly being on as well. I think it's really great for me to be able to take, I took 10 days this time, which felt quite long, but I, at the same time, also my brain reaches a sort of a level, I think, with that sort of deep rest. And that enables then that sort of deeper thinking. One of the things I think I feel quite sad about in the digital age at the moment is that we've lost the art of daydreaming and being bored. Being bored is a great thing. It helps you your mind wander in different areas. And now we're sort of having to actively and almost quite aggressively meditate to get ourselves to that point, which kind of goes against the whole point of it. So going to Indonesia for me is that it's kind of a reset. But I started thinking when I was out there about the idea of sort of multi-indigenous ecosystems, like sort of the embedded philosophies of the Balinese culture. And I was looking and spending some time with people that live out there around the idea of that connection between humans, nature, and the divine. And it goes back to everything we've just talked about. Our Western models compartmentalize ecological and social systems. That's just the way it has been and continues to be. And there's a friction between those things. But Balinese culture operates on an integrated relational framework that's very different. So, for example, the rice fields, the temples, the communities are interdependent networks, which is really interesting because that the guidance for those is both spiritual reverence and practical sustainability. So to be able to spend time in those communities is an absolute gift because you do start to think differently and to go, okay, there is so many options for the way forward, firstly. And the other thing that really occurred to me when I was out there is the idea of sort of how do we help artificial intelligence understand our moral pluralism? We don't have right and wrong that we could all agree upon. So as a consequence, those nuances are going to be really integral as it becomes more and more adept. I'm not going to use the word intelligent, but adept perhaps. And I think that the future of technology shouldn't be about domination and control, of course, but it should be more about reciprocal participation. And living systems have to be a part of that. So I think it's really, really interesting to go to see people, spend time with people that are thinking differently, and also a full digital detox to enable me to come back and sort of ramp up the energy for everything that I want to do. But I very much enjoy being around indigenous communities that do think differently. And as an anthropologist, I'm probably not doing enough of it, to be honest. I remember when I was an undergrad going off to Australia first and sitting around a campfire with some Aboriginal communities. And I was doing some work on different dialects out there. And they had been given, as many as 25, 30 years ago now, they'd been given phones, mobile phones by a tech company out there, a telecom company. And so they were sitting around the fire on phones, but it was from here to there talking because they had no need for them. So sometimes technology is completely and utterly redundant in these situations. And yet we still put it forward because we think everyone wants it and needs it. So I'm hoping to do some more work out in Indonesia around sort of this intersection between sort of the spiritual reverence, practical sustainability, and then technological solutions potentially to some of the problems that they're facing. Yeah.
And that is a fantastic point. Sometimes technology is a solution in search of a problem. That's it.
Right.
Very, very, very good point. Lolly, we've covered a lot of issues, a lot of ground. Is there, before we wrap it up, is there anything that we did not get to talk about, but we should have? Or any last message that you want to make sure our audience takes away from the conversation?
I think probably to summarize the last point really is that we, at the moment, we are craving connection. I'm seeing that in every area. And also seeking perfection, which is very difficult for us because we fear loss. We struggle with letting go. We want intelligence to mean consciousness, but then we're worried about what if it does. When we're engaging with technology, if we're seeking perfection in everything, we're not allowing the failure and the experimentation of us and technology together. And going back to that idea of scientific, the beautiful breakthroughs coming through mistakes, there's going to be mistakes between us and technology too that we can learn a lot from. And at the moment, it's like, oh, it's not ready, or it's not right, or oh, it's hallucinating. That to me is fascinating and sort of much more is engendering itself to me much more because of its own imperfections. And I think it's the imperfections I'd like to know more about, and also about our own. Ultimately, we are imperfectly perfect, and the technology needs to address that or be in line with that in some way.
Excellent. Lolly, Dr. Lolly Mensi, thank you so much for this great conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Very welcome.
And thanks everyone for joining us today. Please do check out the new episodes in this season as we continue to explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and new business models, and how this convergence is reshaping our economic future and our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite place for podcasts is. And you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.